Had somebody in my office.
That's all right. Okay. The April 6, 2017 House Committee on Veterans and Preparedness is now in session. We have several things to do today. We also have a number of folks that are out doing business of the state and the people. So we're going to be moving the agenda around just a little bit to try to accommodate everybody. Please, for the record, if those are seeing that there is a seat on my right that's empty and a seat on my left that's empty, Representative Mark Meek is currently excused, so is Representative Boone. We knew they weren't going to be here, so I don't want people to freak out that people weren't showing up. All right. As is the case on Thursdays, we start with just a reminder of why we're all here, and this one, I think, is particularly important for all of us. On Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017, Air Force Staff Sergeant Alexandria Morrow, who was 25, died while performing maintenance duties in Jordan in support of combat operations. She was a resident of Dansville, New York, serving in the Middle East with the 366th Aircraft Maintenance Squadron of Mountain Home Air Base in Idaho. She was married with two children, and this was her second deployment. She died while loading a bomb on an airplane. According to Mrs. Morrow's mother, something broke, causing a bomb to slip off the plane and hit her daughter in the head. Sometimes in this era of smart bombs and smart weaponry and laser-guided shebang stuff, we forget that it still comes down to people firing weapons, people loading weapons, people doing the hard work of getting ready for war. Those who knew her valued her love of life and art, her leadership, her skills, and her passion. Her actions and contributions as a weapons loader, just in 5 months overseas, let alone 7 years as a gunfighter, have set records for weapons employment in combat. We will dutifully and continually perform the mission while we mourn her loss, said Colonel Jefferson O'Donnell, commander of the 366th Fighter Wing at Mountain Home Air Base in Idaho. Here in Oregon, far from the Middle East, far from Jordan, it's all too easy to forget the hostilities are still going on. It's our job to make sure that when people come home and while they're home and their families during the deployments, that they're all taken care of. So thanks for being here today. We're going to move some things around today. As I mentioned, we're going to move House Bill 3427 down the list just a little bit. I want to make accommodation for the folks that came into down today for House Bill 3207. 3207, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3207, invite Representative Springer up to explain this particular bill and give some folks,
my friends,
the opportunity to share their story about a piece of history not many people have heard about. Mr. Volk, tell us about the bill, and then Representative Springer, we'll go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. House Bill 3207 names Interstate 5 between Albany and Salem, Oregon, the Atomic Veterans Memorial Highway. The United States engaged in atmospheric and underwater nuclear testing from July 16, 1945 to November 4, 1962, exposing an estimated 200,000 more U.S. military service members to unsafe levels of radiation. Due to participation in nuclear weapons testing, these veterans became known as atomic veterans. These veterans were unable to discuss the nuclear weapons test until the tests were declassified many years later. Many weapons died before they were able to seek benefits for their exposure. The United States Department of Veteran Affairs has identified more than 20 cancers and diseases associated with exposure. House Bill 3207 designates Interstate 5 between Albany and Salem, Oregon, the Atomic Veterans Memorial Highway. We have received the fiscal and revenue statements, and the revenue is no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact statement. It's pretty short.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sherry Springer, State Representative for House District 17, and I'm really honored, frankly, to bring this bill before you. So it was back in 2010, in fact, we're just looking at some of this information in my office, that I was invited to speak to a gathering of atomic war veterans in Lebanon. And I happened to have my son, who was still in grade school or high school at that point. And so I went to that, and I got to tell you, I had to do a whole lot of homework Isn't that funny? I do that. I did a whole lot of homework to do some research before I went there because I really didn't know what I was going in there talking about. And as I did some of that research, I became very disturbed, frankly. The good in that is I ended up with these great friendships that now, 7 years later, 6 years later, still go on, and I think we've done some good work for Atomic War veterans. When these gentlemen first came to me, they said, we want a sign, like the other signs on the freeway. And I said, well, let's maybe not do signs yet. Let's talk about what this is. So you'll remember, some of you that have been here a little bit, on the House floor, we passed a resolution acknowledging Atomic War Veteran Day. And we've just done some work to gain awareness. Keep in mind, these were veterans that were not allowed to tell their stories till 1996. And there's still some that don't know that they were Atomic War veterans. If you're put out there and told, guard that building, you don't know what you're guarding, and you don't ask what you're guarding. And so I feel uncomfortable, frankly, every time I testify on this issue or speak on this issue, because, frankly, I just don't feel I have any right to speak on it when I measure that against the sacrifice of the folks that are Atomic War veterans. So what this bill does and you'll see a lot of the language from the earlier resolution. What this bill does is name a portion of Interstate 5 between Albany and Salem as Atomic Veterans Memorial Highway. You'll hear some testimony later that just came to light. So these guys get the decision, and I'll back whatever they say. There's also a section of Interstate 82 up by Hanford in Oregon that is obviously near a nuclear site that's being mentioned. So if there needs to be an amendment for that, we'll talk about that as a subsequent thing. But if these gentlemen want I-5, then we're all in for I-5 and ready to move that.
For the record, the Senate will be dealing with that because we're pushing the bill as it is.
Very good. I'm happy with that. So just very briefly, I was driving to La Grande a month or so ago, and we just bought the first new car we've ever bought together, and I have my cool little camera map, or my map on the screen, on the dash, and different memorial highways popped up on that. I'd never noticed that before. And as it did, I started noticing, I was paying attention to it. I was not diverting my attention from the road to the camera, but I was noticing it. And then I caught myself, and it took me back to, thinking of my father who served in World War II, and different veterans of different eras. Isn't that important to do?
We think so.
Isn't that important to do, to pause and think about that, even if you're heading to La Grande to work on a house or hang out with your kid or go fishing? It's good because of the sacrifice that many have made. We get to do those things. So I think this is important. I want to see you move it forward. I think you are. And these guys are the ones that have the real story.
Please state your name for the record and tell us a little about yourself and why you think this bill should be passed.
Yes. Chairman and committee, my name is Fred Schaefer, and I'm a Salem boy. I was born in Silverton, so I'm a true Oregonian, and I am the Oregon State Commander of the National Association of Atomic Veterans, and also the National Commander of the National Association of Atomic and Nuclear Veterans now, as we're changing. And we worked back in 04, 05 to get this new bill, and Oregon was the first state that made it annually. There was about four states prior to Oregon, and they had to go back and get annually put on their bills. So Oregon has led a lot of it through. I think Oregon was the first one to even do the bottle bill, and look where it is now. But I assume this position as Atomic Veteran, National Commander, and it's been a privilege because I get to tie up with the Marshallese people. And they're in the same boat that we are. You know, and we're working with them in their committees and stuff. So it's just been a privilege to have this opportunity to come before. The only state that I know of that has done this already was Kansas, and I'm going to say they did it in 08 or 09. They did 17 miles in Kansas someplace, and they had a real good celebration. So we want to do the same thing. So many of the guys going down the freeway don't know they can talk about it, and if this will open up and get them to attend some of the meetings that we have, and I've been putting on meetings for over 20 years here in this state, and our state is very well versed in membership. We're doing a lot, but we still have meetings and people show up and say, I didn't know I could talk about it. My wife doesn't even know I am one of you guys. So we'd love to have this bill out there, and I know you've always been behind us before. So I thank you very much for this opportunity to come before you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chairperson and representatives. My name is Frank Farmer. I'm originally from Tennessee, but I've been here since 1971, so I consider myself an Oregonian now. But in any case, I was in Aniwetok in the South Pacific in 58. I was on the deck of the ship through 18 atomic blasts. And I did not know until I met Fred in 2003 that I could speak about it. We were told we couldn't even talk to our doctor about it, anything we had wrong with us. If we did, we would be tried for treason. And with this, we've talked a lot about these signs. If that can get one more person out of the dark and into the VA system or to a doctor or whatever, to me, it would be well worth it, and I would appreciate anything you guys can do for us. This young lady here has been fantastic for us. She's just hard to beat. So I thank you for your time.
Questions, comments? Yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember the first time I saw an atomic blast on TV, it was on, remember the show The Big Picture? That's the first time I'd ever seen that, and that was back in the latter 50s, I believe, early 60s, something like that. At that point, I kind of thought the cat was out of the bag. So I'm surprised it took this long. But thanks for what you did.
Appreciate it.
Comments, questions? Representative Springer, thank you very much for bringing this forward. Gentlemen, thank you for your service, and both the sign should be for recognition of your sacrifice, but hopefully also to spread the word so people know that they can talk about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call forward Mr. John Gabalizan. We're just going to go with John.
Gabriel.
Right, John Gabrielson. We'll go with that.
That was my next guess.
Gary Smith, and, well, we'll call these two forward, and we'll have the next person up after them. Thank you very much for attending today.
Mr. Chairman, representatives.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. If you could
I work the ground troops. I was stationed at the Presidio. We only had the best man there were.
Sir, could you state your name for the record, please?
John Robert Gabrielson.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
My uncle was a senator, by the way. but, oh, I was in the ground troops at the 505th Military Police, and we were the elite in the military. And we were sent to Utah to handle security there. I witnessed a pits being dug. I said, what's that for? And, well, we're going to put animals in there to test. And that was done. And I observed above ground, below ground blasts there. I covered with dust, dirt, so on and so forth. And it so happened that one day my pilot that through the circumference around it. They only blew those when the wind came out of the west, going east to St. George, Utah. He says, I saw the funniest thing today, or it wasn't funny, but I witnessed the fields. The sheep were all dead out there. And the people of St. George, Utah suffered, and many of them gave their lives with this nuclear waste that's in the air. And today, to this day, there's still C-14 in the atmosphere from those above-ground blasts that they had. And there were, I believe it was 400 altogether. And I witnessed that. And then I came back to the Presidio of San Francisco, and then left the military then, was wounded in Korea, but that was earlier. Then came back to the 505th and went through their academy, and they only picked the best. So I felt very proud about that. But I did go through those blasts, and I can't tell you the suffering that I went through. 2 years later, in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning, I wake up just in the worst pain I've ever been in. So I was run to the hospital, Desert Regional Hospital in Palm Springs, and I was there 2 days, had five doctors, couldn't find out what was wrong with me. A doctor come in that was the doctor of the year, the surgeon of the year, and he run his scope in me, tried to get in the right side. Well, I had too much scar tissue. So he run it in the other way. Looks at the gallbladder. It's spitting out green stuff that was it infected my whole body with blood poisoning. And I wasn't expected to live. But I'm here today to tell you about it. Because I can talk. I couldn't do it for 50 goddamn years. Now I can speak about it. And I've suffered ever since. The people in St. George, Utah were taken care of by the government. And very well, I guess, because they suffered too. And I tried to find my brother officers that were with me. They're all dead. I'm still here. So there's got to be a reason for something. Why I'm still here. They have run tests and discovered that with the animals that they had, they were experimenting on those, and they did surgeries and things and found out a number of things that you suffer from. And I happened to be a guinea pig, and I was out there, and I'm lucky to be here today, very lucky, because I've got a number of years of service and served my country well. But for 50 years, I couldn't talk about it. Even to my wife, I could not talk about it. Never said a word to anybody. Anybody that talked, I had to report. I had to report only two that talked. And they were transferred to the front lines in Korea. So that's my story. And I'm a survivor.
Thank you.
Because I don't quit.
Thank you for sharing your stories. Any questions? Thank you, sir. Sir?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Gary Smith. And as a young sailor, I picked up a destroyer in Seattle, Washington, that was there on R&R. And my fellow crew members started telling me these fantastic stories that they just came back from Christmas Island, and they were taking part in nuclear tests, and they were so close that they could see one of the fellows looked at one of the guys next to him, and he said he could see the man's skeleton. And, you know, I thought all these people were just out of their minds, to be honest with you. But shortly after that, a week or so later, I'm down in Johnson Island, and guess what? I went through 4 nuclear tests. And the ship before I went aboard was very close to ground zero, so it was probably very hot with radiation. I was very fortunate when I went down. I was a small distance away, so it wasn't so bad on me. But I still developed cancer, and I'm missing my urinary bladder, my prostate gland, my left kidney, some small intestines, and a few lymph glands from the cancer. Just about every nuclear veteran or atomic veteran has cancer, not all, but just about all. And every nation in the world, except I don't know about the communist countries, but every free nation in the world whose military members took part in nuclear tests have been honored and given special medals by their government. Our government still refuses to recognize us, Senator McCain and the Pentagon. I think they're ashamed to tell the American people what they did to us. And I'm not going to argue the morality of what they did, but for a long time they wouldn't take care of the radiation poisoning and stuff that the veterans were suffering. And I think it's great if the state of Oregon would name this small part of the highway Atomic Veterans and let people know to get the word out. Because like Fred said, there's a lot of veterans that still don't have a clue that they're nuclear veterans. And I didn't know until I met Fred. He was wearing one of these hats. And I asked him, what the heck is NAT? And he told me. I said, well, you know. So that's my story, and I think it would be great for our morale, and I think even more important, it would help inform the public that we exist. Originally, there were 400,000 of us. There's probably less than, I think last time I read some statistics, there was only about 180,000 of us left. And a lot of the members have died of cancer of one sort or another. So I would appreciate it if the state of Oregon honored us and helped inform the public by naming this stretch of the highway, Atomic Veterans Highway. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions or comments? Thank you both for sharing.
Thank you very much, sir.
And
thank you. Love you.
Hopefully in a few minutes we can take the first step toward moving this along. We have 2 more names, 1 signed up and 1 last-minute ad. Mr. Mather from ODOT, please come forward, and Mr. Poole, Les Poole from Clackamas County.
Thank you.
Sir, say your name and where you're from for the record, please.
Les Poole. I live in Clackamas County, and I'm a real veterans advocate, and I dropped in, quite frankly, with no intention of speaking, just to see how the meeting would go, and I wanted to find out more, and I found myself signing up because I've got an interesting story that I'll share very briefly with you. In the 90s, I worked in material handling, and I was everywhere from Willamette Vineyards to Nike to the shipyards. And the company I worked for had some, we'll call them good old guys, that were vets that had worked there forever. And one of them had the anchor on his arm, tattooed. He'd been in the Navy. and he had served in the South Pacific. And it was 1997, and he shared with me that he had been at Bikini Atoll. His best friend was a photographer for the Navy, and he had been flashed, and ever since then he had worn glasses. And he was getting close to retirement, and he said, someday I've got something I want to share with you, something special, but I'm going to do it when I retire, because he said, I'll be dead in 5 years. And, you know, of course, being the type of man he was, he didn't tell me what all was wrong. And in about a year and a half later, when he retired at his retirement party there, he walked up to me afterwards and he gave me photos that were taken at Bikini Atoll and taken on the ship he was on where he was flashed. And the government had placed old surplus ships out in the atoll and filled them full of animals for testing. Well, what happened is when the bomb went off, it was much more dramatic than they expected. And it flipped ships, it turned things upside down, and of course they were all flashed. He told me that his photographer friend had passed away from cancer in 1982 or 3, and I still have these original large format photos that I was, of course, sworn to secrecy, and I've honored that. Obviously, the time to share them is now, and I've shown them to a few folks. But if you see these pictures and realize that here you are unprotected, serving your country on a ship in a war zone, in a way, even though the war's over, and there you are 30, 40 years later, you still can't talk about it. You might talk to somebody at work, and you wait until you're dying before you share it with anybody. And I just want to say that I've talked to others about this, and To speak to the bill, this is the least we can do for these folks. So let's certainly move this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Mather, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. It's an honor and it's humbling to be up here following those gentlemen and their story. As you know, we've worked with various veteran groups over the last several sessions, and we've been honored to be involved with them in placing signs on various highways. It's really been kind of special for our department, as many of our employees are veterans, and we get to learn about their stories and their history and why we're doing the important work we're doing to honor them and recognizing them by putting signs in place. With this particular group, with the Atomic Veterans Group, I actually have a family friend, Jack Bodie. Jack served in the South Pacific, and many of the stories that I've heard today I can relate to in that we've sat around the dinner table just in the last few years and learned more and more about his history and what he was exposed to. So I understand the importance and the value we place on recognizing our veterans, in particular this group. At the Department of Transportation, we also are concerned about highway safety and the amount of signs, distracted drivers, and keeping drivers' attentions on driving. This particular section of I-5 that we're talking about is a congested piece of highway, not congested in the sense that we have in Portland where you're going 5, 10, then back up to 20, back to stop, back to 5 or 10. It's a section of highway that almost on a daily basis, you'll be driving 55 miles an hour, and then you come to a stop, and then you're up to 55 miles an hour again, and then you're at a stop. And just yesterday, we had a pickup flipped in the middle of the freeway. In this situation, 4 people sent to the hospital. So in our efforts just to keep people's attentions on the roadway, my suggestion would be to think about some other sections of highway, similar to what we did in House Bill 2100, where we looked at Highway 20, we looked at pull-offs, rest areas, other alternatives, and we were able to find a successful one. I in no way want to, you know, diminish the importance of this group or diminish that we would not put signs up for them, but I want to make sure we do it in a way we're not compounding an already safety problem that's out there, and see if we can find a way to honor these veterans the way they deserve to be honored, but also to be sensitive to the highway safety issues that we see out there on the highway. In my testimony, you'll see a couple suggestions, but we're really open to sit down and continue to have conversations to find an appropriate way and a safe way to honor these veterans.
Thank you. Any comments or questions?
All right. Thank you both.
Thanks.
All right. Before I close the public hearing, any last-minute add-ons on this? Understanding we have about six more bills we need to work today. Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing. Is there a... yes.
Well, you're intending to move it.
I am.
With that,
with the hope that it'll be fixed in the Senate on that. Because of guidelines.
Okay.
Which I'll explain once we get a motion. Okay. Going to open the work session on House Bill 31, correction, House Bill 3207. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3207 to the floor with the due pass recommendation that the bill be subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 3207 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that be subsequently referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion? To the point about perhaps looking at other alternatives, because of timelines right now, I'd like to move it to Ways and Means. While it's in Ways and Means, there can be a work group emphasizing the Senate in terms of figuring out where's most appropriate. At least that would be my preference for the committee. Any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, call the roll.
Representative Lewis.
Mr. Chair, it's an honor to cast an aye vote.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Lewis. I need an aye.
He said yes.
Aye. Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Excused.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. Motion passes. And once it pops back up out of Ways and Means, we'll ask that hopefully Representative Springer can carry it. But, of course, that'll be up to Ways and Means. Thank you all for coming today. Appreciate your sacrifice and service. And there was somebody who was not able to attend today because he was also an atomic veteran who passed on several years back, Colonel Hilton, who I think will be happy with this bill as well. All right, we're going to move back to 3427. We're going to open a public hearing on 3427. Representative Lewis, would you like to come forward and explain to us your bill? While he's walking down, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. House Bill 3427 requires the owner or operator of a dam with a high hazard rating to develop an emergency action plan with the Water Resources Department, the Office of Emergency Management, and the Emergency Services Agency in the country where the dam is located. It directs the WRD to determine the frequency of emergency response exercises at such dams in consultation with OEM and the local Emergency Services Agency. It requires the WRD to inspect such dams annually unless it determines that a different inspection schedule is appropriate and adequate to ensure the seismic safety of the dam. I would note that there is a Dash 1 amendment that removes that last requirement, so it modifies the inspection, removing the language in the original bill quoted as, and is adequate to ensure the seismic safety of the dam. As far as background, Oregon has dams of many different sizes and uses. Some dams are for generating power and are very large, and some are quite small to create ponds. Oregon has approximately 1,300 large dams that store water for many purposes and more than 10,000 smaller dams. Oregon currently has 75 high-hazard dams, and 58 of those have emergency action plans, and 13 have early warning system. House Bill 3427 defines high-hazard dams as those where loss of life is expected should the dam fail, and requires owners or operators of such dams to develop emergency action plans. The measure further directs the Water Resources Department to determine the frequency for conducting emergency response exercises at high-hazard dams and to inspect them annually. And I would note again that there is a Dash 1 amendment to remove the language and is adequate to ensure the seismic safety of the dam.
Representative Lewis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Lewis. I'm state representative for House District 18. I'm here to present House Bill 3427. I think the committee will recall about a month ago we heard testimony from Water Resources concerning high-hazard dams, and the question was posed about whether or not all high-hazard dams in the state were required to have an emergency action plan. The answer was no. In researching the Oregon administrative rules that for Department of Water Resources, it was learned that for newly constructed high-hazard dams, they're required to have an emergency action plan as a part of their construction phase. However, other high-hazard dams, the older dams, were encouraged to have one. They weren't required to have one. And just to clarify, high-hazard dams are defined in Oregon administrative rule as those that have the potential for a loss of life downstream from the dam in the event of a catastrophic failure. This bill is intended to require that those dams that are under regulation by the state Department of Water Resources, they're a high hazard, they're required to have an emergency action plan. The particulars of the emergency action plan are actually outlined and taken directly from the Oregon administrative rules for Department of Water Resources, and it goes beyond that to require that each of those high hazard dams submit their emergency action plan to the Department of Water Resources, also to the Oregon Emergency Management Agency, and to the county emergency management agency in the county in which the dam is located. This would include all state-regulated public and privately owned dams. Just as a little bit, and it also would require that dams or the action plans be periodically exercised with local emergency response personnel. It can be done in accordance with whatever the timetable is that the Department of Water Resources would establish. So it would be up to them on the frequency of those exercises. It could be a tabletop, or it could be a full-scale functional exercise. That would be up to them. And just as a little bit of information, there are currently 75 high-hazard dams in the state that are privately owned and 37 that are publicly owned that are regulated by the state of Oregon. 34 of the 37 publicly owned dams currently have an emergency action plan, and two of those are currently in progress, so it would be a total of 35 of the 37. On the privately owned side, the 24 of the 38 currently have emergency action plans, and there are seven that are currently in progress. I didn't include anything in the bill regarding early warning systems because they can be a little bit expensive, but there are some of the high hazard dams that are regulated by the state that do have early warning systems at the present time. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of the representative?
I have one.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, Representative, I'm on this bill as well, but I just thought, who pays for the inspections?
Speak to what?
Who pays for the work being done on these dams?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, cost of the emergency action plans would be borne by the owner of the dam, whether it's private or publicly owned.
Okay. And if there's an inspection?
There's an inspection.
The inspections are done by the
same people?
The inspections are actually done by the Department of Water Resources. And they do those now, I believe, annually.
Okay. There will be a physical. That's what I'm leading up to. I wanted to make sure because there was nothing in here.
I haven't seen the impact statement on it, but they inspect the dams annually anyway. Okay, so
why don't we, to that note, yeah. Water Resources? I could see you wanted to testify. I could just see the smile on your face.
You just can't stand it. Yes,
I'm anticipating a small fiscal because this is what you normally do at other dams, but I'm looking forward to hearing your words.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, for the record, Raquel Rancier, Senior Policy Coordinator with the Oregon Water Resources Department. We have been speaking with the fiscal person that's, I guess it hasn't come in yet. So. We have several and POPs. Well, we have two POPs, I guess I could say. One is related to increasing...
That'd be policy option package,
yes,
right?
Not Diet Pepsi or Coca-Cola. So we have one policy option package that's related to our dam safety program and staffing in that program. And then we have another one that is related to increasing the fees within that program. So owners of dams, they pay a fee based on how... on their hazard rating. So we have under one of those POPs, it's a 15.88% increase, which is based on the estimated cost increases from DAST. That schedule is set to revert back to 2009 levels if nothing is done this session. In addition, we have a POP that's related to staffing within the agency. So we have this dam safety program is funded by general fund, federal funds, as well as the fees. And so I explained the fee component of that. And what we have had in the past is that we have Keith Mills here, our state engineer, one body doing all these inspections. In addition, we've had a limited duration position, which we have not been able to get permanent. So this proposal is to make that permanent because we've had to keep retraining. And so we cannot, we do annually inspect these high hazard dams. We cannot do it without that one position. And so I don't know how fiscal will handle that in terms of the context of the bill, since it is a proposal that's before the Joint Ways and Means Committee. If we have the two positions, we can certainly carry out these functions. If we only have one position, then we're going to have some challenges. I'll also note that we do have 900 dams in the state that are inspected by this program, and we have assistant watermasters and watermasters that assist with inspecting those lower hazard dams, but we do like to have our engineers doing the inspections on those high hazard dams. So I think that answered the question.
So if I could compartmentalize it into first grader Air Force thinking here.
It's Air Force for you.
I know. The governor's budget and POPs, policy option packages, for a number of other purposes that are going forward that are currently being considered by Ways and Means, that this particular bill is at the right time to be considered at the same time for the utility of that other function, that these could marry up very closely. If it's not funded, it would be a problem. But if it's funded, it can be absorbed by the staffing, the levels that you're putting in place.
Evans, that is correct. So okay. I suspect it may end up having a fiscal associated with, because that's not our current budget.
But if at Ways and Means they're planning on doing it anyway, it would be seen as a zero add, right?
Yes.
Other questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much for clarifying that. I have one other question.
Sure.
Right now there's a Dash 1 amendment that was done as a group effort, which is good. Are you aware of a potential Dash 2 amendment, or is someone going to be speaking to that in a bit? Because they're not on the paper that I have right here, so I'm confused by that. So in a minute, we're going to hear about a potential Dash 2. Thank you very much for that answer. I appreciate that. Representative Lewis, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Chair Evans, members of the committee, just one other comment on the Dash 1 amendment. It was determined that there was quite a fiscal impact if we left the requirement for seismic evaluation of the high hazard dam, so that's the reason that was taken out.
But it's still strongly encouraged.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Okay. I hope so.
Yes. Great. Thank you very much. And going to try to be clairvoyant here, but I'm anticipating somebody coming up next to explain about a possible Dash 2 amendment. Ms. Howe, you do not look like
Ms.
Howe.
No, Ms. Howe is in the hallway. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of Pacific Corp, Pacific Power. We have three dams located in the state of Oregon, two on the North Umpqua, one on the Klamath. And the current FERC regulations,
FERC being?
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. We are regulated under this with our action plans now, and I think we just want to work with Representative Lewis, and we may have, again, I've just gotten some initial feedback that we may just need clarification that, because we meet these standards already in our FERC it would be it possibly be duplicative. And so we want to just make it sure that it's not getting interfering with those FERC regulations. So I think it's, again, we need to work through that, but I just wanted to put that on the record, whether it's here in this committee or working with Representative Lewis in the Senate, we're open to that.
Okay. So I see Water Resources smiling. Do you have other comments you'd like to add or not? Feel free to come forward.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, again, for the record, Raquel Rancier with the Oregon Water Resources Department. We've had some conversations with Representative Lewis about this, and our interpretation has been that this applies to state-regulated dams. It sounds like there may be a desire to clarify that in the bill. We did note that it is not exactly clear. If you look at the definition of high hazard, it says high hazard is a dam that is determined by the Water Resources Department to be to result in loss of life. And so presumably we'll be determining that only for our state-regulated dams. And then there is the federal programs. FERC is one of those programs. And we certainly, if we were required to do double duty on those, which, as you point out, they already have these similar provisions, we would then be definitely have a fiscal impact associated with this because they have about the same amount of high hazard dams. We have two people that were requesting for this, so it would double the need on staff and be duplicative.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair and Representative Lewis, to the bill, and I think that is the intent, and I think we just have a few clarifications that would, I think, further clarify that. It's pretty minor.
So let me play go-between for just a minute.
Okay.
Representative Lewis, is it acceptable that you work on clarifying this language and that the goal be coming back by next Thursday with language to move the bill?
Mr. Chair, yes, absolutely.
Could we perhaps get clarification by that time?
Chair Evans, members of the committee, absolutely.
Yep. Thank you.
Best answer. Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing with the goal of bringing it back.
I guess he wants to.
Oh, we're going to reopen the public hearing.
Gotcha.
We're going to be moving forward on lots of stuff today, but please
know,
come forward.
I'm really going to hurry. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon, but I promised Representative Lewis that I would be here.
Yes.
Raquel sort of stole my thunder, but the reason I'm here is not only to generally support the bill, but for Representative Lewis and Representative Esquivel, they know that I follow the budgets. And so it is really important for us to have the policy option package that does permanently create a second dam safety person at Water Resources. That is critical to making this work. The other one is the fee bill to make sure that we and by the way, fees at Water Resources do not cover the entire thing. That Water Resources is one of those natural resource agencies for whom the general fund supports a great deal of their work. So we're interested in supporting the bill so long as we don't have an additional fiscal that causes us great harm since we have no money this session.
Understood.
So I do want to mention that. And I also want to say very quickly that besides the Water Resources Assistant Water Masters, and by the way, we're asking for a few more of those in the Water Resources budget that can help with this issue. The Department of Agriculture, when they go out into the rural lands, actually does at least a cursory look at dams when they go out. So my reason for saying that is to say that we're trying our best to cross-agency get rid of silos and have cross-agency work to accomplish tasks. So thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
All right. We're going to close the public hearing on 3427 with the same expectation of bringing it back by next Thursday, hopefully. Okay. All right, we're going to proceed. We're going to skip around just a little bit because I want to move the HCRs as soon as we can as well. I'm going to open a public hearing on HCR 25. Mr. Bolt.
Thank you, Representative. I need to text.
This is a different one.
Yeah. House Concurrent Resolution 25 recognizes and honors Sergeant Adam Plumondor, 1982 to 2005, for service to his country. Sergeant Adam Plumondor was born on October 5th, 1982, in Gresham, Oregon, where he was an athlete at Gresham High School.
After graduating from high school in 2001, he enlisted in the United States Army to serve his country and gain valuable experience towards his goal of becoming a police officer after completion of his military service. He became a world-class sniper, placing third in the 2003 United States Army International Sniper Competition. The Army assigned him to the 1st Battalion, 1st Brigade, 25th Infantry Division at Fort Lewis, Washington, and he deployed to Iraq in October 2004, 3 days before the expected end of his military service. In December 2004, he saved six wounded soldiers from a burning vehicle and engaged the enemy in a firefight. On February 16, 2005, he was killed on patrol in Mosul, Iraq, when an improvised explosive device detonated near a Stryker vehicle. He was a vehicle commander that day, riding in an open air hatch that provided good line of sight for protecting the lives of his platoon members, but that left him exposed. He had received numerous awards and decorations, to include the Bronze Star, the Army Commendation Medal, three Army Achievement Medals. He also earned the Expert Infantry Badge, Combat Infantry Badge, Expert Rifle Badge, and Valorous Unit Award. He was nicknamed the Gentle Giant for his stature and good nature. He loved the outdoors and all things country and western. He put protecting the lives of his platoon above all else and was deeply respected for his courage and leadership. House Concurrent Resolution 25 honors Sergeant Adam Plumador and his family for their sacrifice during the Iraq War.
Colleagues, members of the committee, Representative Peluso regrets that she could not be here to carry this today. But as we recall, she was a member of this committee and appeared previously. She asked me to read a few comments in asking for passage today. Chair and members of the committee, she's saying aye. She's here to tell the story of Adam Plumador. Adam was a young man who grew up in Gresham, as explained earlier. At Gresham High School, Adam competed in track, baseball, and football. He enjoyed spending time with his family. They tell me that you could find him in his cowboy hat, listening to country music, fishing, hunting, riding in his pickup truck or motorcycle, and generally enjoying the outdoors. Adam Plumador stood at 6'2" and had an easygoing nature, quick sense of humor, and ability to find the positive in everything. As was said earlier, he was also known as a gentle giant. Adam dreamed of becoming a Gresham police officer, enlisted in the United States Army to gain experience toward that goal. Sergeant Adam Plumador was assigned to the 1st Battalion, 24th Infantry Regiment, 1st Brigade, 25th Infantry Division, based at Fort Lewis in Washington, and was deployed to Iraq in October of 2004. Sergeant Plumador served with a sense of humor. He was a soldier who tended to go on patrol with his chin strap unfastened and his sleeves rolled up, causing his commanding officer to jest that he was a walking uniform violation. I understand that. But he was also an accomplished world-class sniper, placing third in the 2003 United States Army International Sniper Competition. Sergeant Plumador's numerous military awards and decorations, including a Bronze Star with V Device for Valor, Bronze Star, Purple Heart, Army Commendation Medal with V Device for Valor, Army Commendation Medal, and three Achievement Medals, as has been said earlier. More importantly, Sergeant Plumador put his fellow soldiers first. As was stated, in December of 2004, Sergeant Plumador helped save six wounded soldiers from a burning vehicle and then engage the enemy in a firefight. His fellow soldiers credit him with saving lives many, many times over. On February 16th, Sergeant Plumador was killed in action, as has been talked about, because of an improvised explosive device detonated near the vehicle. Representative Peluso was the Gresham police chief when this occurred, and she had learned of Sergeant Plumador's death. It was her honor to attend his military funeral in 2005, and she was honored and is honored now to bring this forward for our consideration on the extraordinary service of Sergeant Adam Plumador. He was a young man that made the ultimate sacrifice. His dreams of becoming a police officer were never realized, but the life he lived was full of service, friendship, and meaning. It is important that we recognize and honor Sergeant Adam Plumador for his service to his country, and that is the reason that she would ask for unanimous support of HCR 25. Any other comments? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on HCR 25. I ask to open a work session on HCR 25.
Mr. Chair, I move HCR 25 to the floor with two adopt recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves HCR 25 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, Sky, call the roll.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Excused.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Yes. Motion passes, and we will ask Representative Peluso to carry it on the floor. Representative Huffman has been notified.
Yes, Chairman Evans, I just sent him a text at his cell, so HCR 26.
We're going to stand at ease for about 2 minutes. We are back. The 2017 April 6th meeting of the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. We're going to open a public hearing on HCR 26. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Evans. Appreciate the opportunity to make a presentation today. I'm John Huffman, State Representative for House District 59, which includes Madras down in Jefferson County. So HCR 26 recognizes and honors Private First Class Thomas L. Tucker. I will call him Tom, as everybody else does. Born in 1981 and was killed in 2006. We're honoring him for his service to this country. Tom was raised in Madras, graduated from Madras High School in 1999. He was an accomplished pianist, played the guitar, trombone, saxophone. If I had a fraction of that musical ability, he was a building contractor and enjoyed doing things with others, and his parents tell me that he was known for his enthusiasm, loyalty, optimism, and ability to make others laugh. Shouldn't we all? Tom enlisted in the United States Army in 2005 and was an infantryman assigned to the 1st Battalion, 502nd Infantry Regiment, 2nd Brigade, 101st Airborne Division, known as the Screaming Eagles, based out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Tom was deployed to Iraq in February 2006 during Operation Iraqi Freedom. Tom was killed in action on June 16, 2006, near Baghdad. Tom was awarded the Bronze Star, Purple Heart, Iraq Campaign Medal, and the Combat Infantryman Badge. Governor Kulongoski spoke of Private First Class Thomas L. Tucker as a son of Oregon and a true American hero, adding that his sacrifice is a testament to his honor and courage, and his bravery on the battlefield will not be forgotten, which is why we're here today. Tom Tucker is survived by his parents, Wes and Meg Tucker, and his sister, Tava. It's another loss. We talk about him every session, but we don't want to forget the sacrifice of people like Tom Tucker. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee.
Mr. Volt.
Chairman Evans, I think the representative has summarized greatly, perfectly what is in this resolution. I'd only add that we've received the fiscals and revenue. There's no expenditure impact, no revenue impact. I will just simply summarize again. House Concurrent Resolution 26 recognizes and honors Private First Class Thomas L. Tucker and his family for their sacrifice during the Iraq War.
Representative Huffman, we had not met at the time, but in 2006 I was actually at the funeral for Mr. Tucker. At the time, there was an organization that called themselves a church out of Kansas that was threatening to protest that particular funeral. And Mr. Tucker, the circumstances of his death were unique in many ways, have been reported in other places. They're not salient for today. But the Patriot Guard actually came out. It was one of the first times the Patriot Guard had been as public in protecting the family to make sure that the funeral was, in fact, honoring
Mr. Tucker and not used for some other purpose. This particular passing means a great deal to me as well, and I'm truly grateful for you bringing this one forward. On the list, there is somebody who would like to add to the mix. Mr. Connect, please come forward.
And Mr. Chair, the parents wanted to be here. They're working folks just like us and a lot of people, and they hope to be here for the floor part of it, but weren't able to be here today.
If we need to make special arrangements for that family, we can.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Go ahead. Say your name for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Mark Knick of Representative Evans, and the chair in the committee. I stand behind this man, and I support this, and I also was out at his service, too. And I support veterans, and there's a number of you on this panel who have served in the military, and I want to thank you for your service also.
Well, thank you.
Any questions? Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
One final thing. Next time you're in Madras, if you're heading up toward my hometown of the Dalles, right behind Safeway, as you're on Highway 97 heading north-ish, there's a neat sign on the right side of the highway that says Tom Tucker. Nice memorial to him alongside the road there.
Good. Thank you very much. Seeing no other comments, we're going to close the public hearing on HCR 26. We're going to open a work session on HCR 26.
Mr. Chair, I move HCR 26 to the floor with the adopt recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves HCR 26 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there a discussion? Okay. Seeing no discussion, Sky, please call the roll.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Excused.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Yes. Passes. We're going to ask that Representative Huffman carry the bill, if that's acceptable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for bringing it forward. All right. We are now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2891 with hopefully an amendment. Or two amendments.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. House Bill 2891 directs the Department of Veterans Affairs to submit legislature to the Legislative Assembly no later than July 1st, 2018. I would say that this original bill is essentially a complete gut and stuff, and that the amendment up to the dash 2 replaces the original bill measure.
Thank you.
And the amendment establishes the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, the ODVA, Advisory Committee Grant Fund, separate from the general fund, permits the ODVA to award grants of $25,000 to $250,000 with Advisory Committee approval for specified purposes, provides for transfer of monies from the Oregon State Lottery Fund established under Article 15, Section 4D of the Oregon Constitution, monies appropriated by the Legislative Assembly, interest earnings, donations, and other deposits. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs administers a wide variety of program and services for the more than 326,000 veterans. House Bill 2891 requires ODVA to submit a report of the delivery of such services and establishes, per the amendment, an advisory committee grant fund.
Okay, members of the committee, and we're going to ask the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and his able legislative affairs direct assistant, if she would like to come up. What this does, basically, the dash two amendment is, as we have been talking about, it gives the existing advisory committee of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. It establishes a grant program. It establishes that for the various number of folks who have come before us over the course of the session with ideas for pilot programs, for initiatives, service groups, nonprofits, etc. It will provide a fund, a group to oversee the fund, and a $25,000 to $250,000 amount that the advisory board can award to pilot programs that meet a basic criteria. That's what we're doing with this. So it is what we did is we basically had a placeholder bill. We got it and stuffed it. We basically give ODVA advisory committee, again, so people have full transparency. It's advisory committee that is appointed by the governor and is approved by the Senate, so everybody knows who those folks are. And it basically creates a capability that we haven't had before. That's what it does. Director Smith, any comments on this that you'd like to add? Or
good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And we've had, since our founding of our agency in 1945, have had that nine-member veteran advisory committee for our agency. And we think it is a huge strength of our department, having that cross-geographic, across the state, diversity from young to older and wiser veterans really runs the gamut. And they are value-added, not just to our own programs, but advising us and counseling us on the issues that they see arising for the veterans community as they come up. Also in our statutes, we've had often the legislative intent to, as we stand up a grant, whether it's to the county VSOs or the national service organizations, to ensure that we get the advice and counsel of the advisory committee on those grant programs. Similarly, often, specifically on the county ones, also highlighting the to get the counsel and work collaboratively with the Association of Oregon Counties on those specific grants. So we do view this as a similar mission. It would be a little bit different where in this current amendment that it would be a more formal decision-making authority and a vote by the advisory committee on the grant making. So that would be a pivot for the legislature to consider whether to keep that authority on the grant making decisions with the director and with the agency with the advice and counsel of the advisory committee, or more of a formal authority for the advisory committee. So that's one decision point. Very broad latitude in terms of the kinds of different efforts that we would be able to make grants out of this amendment. Similar where the emergency assistance grant program is for individual veterans and families with broad latitude, this would be a similar discretion, but more to organization and nonprofit and other partners. I think that's all I have, and happy to answer any questions.
In the dash two, you'll notice a whole litany of different uses that the committee can be. Basically, what we tried to do is put sideboards on it so that, on the one hand, we would allow enough creativity and flexibility for local initiatives that think they have a good idea. And on the other hand, we're not throwing birthday parties and doing other things that may not have any specific outcome.
Are the dash twos posted?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They should have. It's been out for a while.
And 31, 32.
2891. Yes. 2891.
Okay.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? This is just an opportunity to make sure that we're on the same page. Any questions come? Okay. Thank you very much. I actually have a person who wants to come up and testify on this as well. Mr. Connect. Don't go too far, though. We might need you for the next one. Thank you very much, both. And what's the name of your helper today, by the way?
Kino.
All right.
Yes.
Kino, nice job hiding. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, I'm Representative Paul Evans and the chair again. My name's Mark Knick, and I reside in Marion County, and I'm an honorably discharged veteran from the Department of the Army, and I stand behind Cameron Smith and all he's doing and all you've done. And now, has the governor put that money back in? I got a thing in the mail today, or I got a thing today at the mail at our Veterans Task Force today.
On this measure, thank you for your comments. In regard to the governor's most recent statements, last week, I'm told, I was not at the event, but I'm pretty certain, that the governor is now asking the legislature for basically a full measure of the lottery set aside in addition to what would have been called existing service levels for ODVA.
Yeah. I support all these measures here.
Yes. So in a perfect world, we will all be on the same page and actually have about $28 million plus or minus, perhaps maybe as much as 30 for veteran services. Thank you.
All right.
Any other? I'm going to close the public hearing.
Did you have something to say?
I just had a question because I've just pulled up the ORS.
During work session, can we?
Yeah, we can ask during work session.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Open a work session on 2891. The first piece before we can do anything else is the consideration of the dash two amendments, if that's possible. I see a question. No? No?
No.
My question is relates to the amendment. So I've pulled open the handy dandy, Oregon laws. Advisory committee shall appoint 9 people all of whom are veterans. So we do make sure that those are geographically sort of saying, I heard you say that. And do we try to get that across all services and we're doing all that, right?
Yes.
Just wanted to confirm
that.
That
has been the tradition and expectation.
Okay, good. All right. I wanted to know.
Okay. Any other questions on the dash twos? Just because this is a little bit of a complicated gut and stuff, I'm going to ask for a full vote on the dash twos, if that's acceptable. Sky, why don't you call the roll for the dash two?
Can we make an amendment?
We have a script.
Well, first we have to do a dash.
That's a script.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt to House Bill 2891, the dash two amendments, dated March 28, 2017.
Representative Esquivel moves to adopt the 2891-2 amendments dated March 28, 2017. Is there further discussion on the dash twos? Seeing none, now call the.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Excused.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. The dash twos pass, so the bill is now amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2891 as amended to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a subsequent referral to chair of the Committee on Ways and Means?
Representative Esquivel moves 2891 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be subsequently referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Yes, ma'am.
Thanks. So first of all, Mr. Chair, I really appreciate where we're headed with this. I want to get a couple things on the record for legislative intent, or at least my legislative intent, in supporting this. And for those who have not served on this committee before, but in 2013, when we brought HJR 29, which was a 5% Oregon lottery bill, which had 59 sponsors from the body on it, and we couldn't get it out of committee. And we then subsequently came back and did that all the rigmarole again, and we created sort of this measure 96, and voters voted for it. When we drafted the HJR 29 in 2013, it was, and Martha Schrader and I worked on that, we really wanted nonprofits to be able to go out and serve. And I just really think that it is important that we have a process where they don't all have to come to the legislature and we have to run them through the ways and means process every single time. Or you hear some of our colleagues talk about wanting evidence-based practices or whatever. Sometimes you just have to do the work. And you might not have a book report study to go with it and to solve some of these problems. And so this mechanism, I think, is important. I want to say that I don't necessarily want ODVA to be the decision maker. I like the piece where we're asking that a majority of the members of that board are weighing in because it's by veteran for veteran, which was the original purpose of the bill and of HJR 29 and the signature gathering, multiple signature gathering efforts, was really that this was about veterans telling us how to use the money rather than bureaucrats, no offense, director, telling them how to use the money and in the way that they see fit. And so I like where this is going, and I want to get that intent on the record that this is really about being able to have what I think voters intended, which is making sure these dollars are boots on the ground in a cost-efficient way, which nonprofits in our state do. Maybe even to start trying to, my hope would be that this board would start to try to aggregate some of the nonprofit work that is happening out there and consolidate around some of the opportunity for these grants, and that we continuously fund this.
To that point, members of the committee, the mechanism is exactly that. It would be by creating the fund and by creating the expectation and the mechanism, it would not only allow nonprofits, among others, to seek grants for activities, it would also be, at least this framework is anticipated to be the model for future years as well, so that there's always a pilot experiment option through this, and if programs are proven through that process to be exceptional, then we might be able to add them into permanent state. So that's kind of the best that Senator Boquist, myself, and the Marine director of ODVA, and other people came together to try to really find that balance. So I think that your concerns of the past and the clarification for language today is critical. I really do.
Don't forget about the older, more experienced.
Yes, the older, well. More experienced part. I think he has not forgotten that, yes. Any other comments? Seeing none, we're going to be voting on the bill. Hit it, Sky.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Excused.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. Motion passes. And I will actually assign myself this one once it pops out of Ways and Means, if that's acceptable. Mm-hmm. We're going to open a public hearing on 3132. Mr. Volk, why don't you explain 3132, and then we will invite up Mr. Director Cameron.
Thank you, Chairman. This had originally been on the schedule for March 23rd. We carried it over. House Bill 3132 establishes the Veteran Services Fund in the Oregon State Treasury pursuant to an amendment to the Oregon Constitution approved in Ballot Measure 96, 2016. Directs that monies in the fund are continuously appropriated to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and may be used only to provide services for the benefit of veterans. Amends current law by adding the Veteran Services Fund to the list of identified investment funds. Declares an emergency, takes effect upon passage. We have received the fiscal, it's called Fiscal Light, Revenue Light. As far as background, about 100% of Oregon's voting legislatures approved House Joint Resolution 2002 and 2016. Ballot Measure 96 was placed into the Oregon voting ballot and approved by voters. The ballot measure amended the Oregon Constitution by creating a new Section 4F to be added to and made part of Article 15. The amendment allowed 1.5% of the state lottery proceeds to veteran services, which may include 1, reintegration, employment, education, benefits, and tuition, housing, physical and mental health, and addiction treatment programs. 2, assistance for veterans or their dependents to access state and federal benefits. 3, funding for services provided by county and veteran service officers, campus veteran service officer, or nonprofit or tribal veteran service officers. Based on the June 2016 forecast from the Office of Economic Analysis, 1.5% of net lottery proceeds for veteran services would be approximately $9.3 million annually for the 2017-2019 biennium. House Bill 3132 establishes the Veteran Services Fund and directs that monies appropriated to the ODVA from the fund be used to provide services only for veterans.
All right. What this does is it is basically ensuring that there is a fund that links the ballot measure lottery stuff to everything else. Then in Ways and Means, they will be able to put the appropriate amount of funding when all the games are done and we know how much we have into this fund. The other fund will have money come out of this fund to be able to populate for the grants, et cetera. So this is one of those things we need to have in existence. My goal is we send it down so that as the discussion over end state happens, and hopefully we're able to move past, significantly hopefully past, the Ways and Means framework, that the money from the lottery can basically be put into this account with some set aside for the advisory committee grant process. Make sense? It's creating a fund. But it also makes sure that people know that it's the Veterans Lottery Fund. All right. Any questions? I don't see any questions. Any clarification necessary? Seeing none. Mark, do you want to testify on this? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the lead bureaucrat, apparently, for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And on principle, I'd just simply like to oppose this measure because I believe it was introduced by Representative Parrish with all her comments about bureaucracy. But this is an administrative nature, creating this fund, and we are happy to support. And a few key things always, that the interest on this fund retained in the fund is another key point for the longevity as well.
So we're trying to do some, hopefully, anti-sweepy prevention here is the goal. All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3132. I'm going to open a work session on 3132.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3132 to the floor with a B-pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 3132 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation that it be subsequently referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Well, I will. For our poor bureaucratic director, there is a theory in psychology called displacement. So given that you're here testifying about this, you're just taking the brunt of that. But no, I really appreciate that we're doing this. I think, you know, the fact is when the chair and Senator Olson and I sat and wrote the voters pamphlet statement for what Measure 96 would be, we made a commitment that these funds belong to veterans, and voters overwhelmingly, I can't find a ballot measure that passed higher in Oregon's ballot history than this ballot measure, and it sends a very strong message that this is what voters want, this is what they expect of us. They expect a fully funded veteran service program. They expect that these dollars are not going to be swept for anything, and that they get to where they are, and this as a mechanism combined with the other bill that we just passed to do that granting piece, it really is probably one of the most important things I think we'll do for veterans this year.
Okay. Other comments, questions? Okay. Seeing no other comments, questions. Sky, please call the roll.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Excused.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Yes, aye. Passes. And I will also assign myself and Representative Parrish as co-carriers on this, should it pop back up from Ways and Means be necessary to carry as an actual bill, as opposed to a budget note. Okay? All right. What I'd like to do is I'd like to roll 3319 to next Thursday. That's acceptable to everybody.
Mr. Chair,
yes, sir. Go ahead.
May I say something to my fellow members here? Please read 3319, because I'd sure like to see you get on the bill, because it's an exceptionally good bill, and what it does.
Did you write it?
It puts the level of funding from the 15-17 biennium, and then adds on for inflation through an index. Plus, it also does our separate monies from the lottery would be added on top of it, so it stops that from being taken out of the general fund.
Good job.
Okay, so Representative Esquivel is asking everybody who listens to this and everybody who we talk to, perhaps even more members of the legislature than beyond just this committee, mm-hmm. to sign on to 3319. What it does, yeah. It basically clarifies what existing service level is. It sets in some adjustment for inflation for over time so that we don't have confusion in the future about what the voters intended by the word additional resources from lottery for veterans outreach. I think that's what it's trying to get to. So 3319, we will
stabilize it out.
We'll move it to next Thursday for possible action. And we have an update. Mr. Volk, go ahead.
I've heard from Sky Kavet that we received the fiscal on House Bill 3427. I've not had a chance to review it. I'm not sure if it'll make our decision. What we'll do, but could we just stand at ease just to have a chance to review it real quickly?
Well, I think we're going to be working on that next week.
Okay. Yeah. Do you want to carry it over to Tuesday or Thursday?
I'd like to carry it over to Thursday. Okay. Representative Lewis won't be here on Tuesday, so I'd like him to be here for Thursday.
Representative Lewis, Thursday is acceptable?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. But I do want to we'll publicly acknowledge the hard work of fiscal to get it to us by the end of the meeting today, and look forward to hopefully having the next fiscal the next Thursday. All right. Anything else for the good of the order? All right, Mr. Volk, can you give us a quick snapshot on what to look for on Tuesday, and then we will close this one up.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Evans. Let me grab our agendas here.
We're going to be having, for the next couple of weeks, not a lot of informational hearings. We're going to be trying to move legislation so we meet our requirements.
Do we have a lot of Senate bills coming to us?
We have a few. Okay. We will be picking those up probably on the other side of the deadline.
Okay.
We have for the agenda next Tuesday House Bill 2890 and House Bill 2847, which we are hoping to have amendments to. Also, House Bill 2887, HDRs 28, 29, and 30. And okay. The following Thursday, we'll be voting on several bills in a work session, HCR 27, and we're carrying over two bills from today.
And again, for the committee, we have two outstanding amendments, one from Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs that we are seeking clarity on in terms of the mortgage refi piece.
2847.
And we also have, I need to talk to ODV before you leave on that one. And Oregon Military Department has an amendment that they're trying to get clarification on, having to do with the National Guard Reserve loan program that will be able to help for education. 2890. Any other questions? All right. Thank you all for your hard work today. We are closed. Adjourned. Out of here. We are closed. Adjourned. Out of here.